We really value our right to free speech in this country, which is probably why that right is enshrined in Amendment Number 1 in the Constitution. But how much do we value the free speech rights of people we disagree with? In the eyes of our next guest, not much if we're talking about the left-wing's appreciation of the free speech rights of people who aren't left-wingers. The title of Kimberly Strassel's book pretty well sums it up, The Intimidation Game, How the Left is Silencing Free Speech. Kimberly Strassel is an Oregon native who has worked for the Wall Street Journal since 2007, writing the Potomac Watch column and serving as a member of the editorial board at the Journal. She's our guest in the exchange. Kimberly, thanks for joining us.
As you just said, I'm so happy to be on. I am an Oregon native.
From where?
I grew up in the Coast Range on the way from Portland going out to Seaside.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So, yeah, definitely the Oregon experience. The book begins with Citizens United, and this is a decision that certainly has been a great subject of debate for 6 years plus now, a decision you appear to agree with. What is it that you like about it?
Well, what was great about Citizens United was the Supreme Court had basically got rid of a bunch of speech laws, and I call them speech laws because some people call them campaign finance laws, but, you know, money is a proxy for speech. You cut down on money, and you are, in essence, taking away people's ability to participate in democracy. So they got rid of that, and they, as a result, allowed a lot of people that had, in essence, been barred from the political debate to come back in. But the left didn't like that very much.
Now, the equivalence of money in speech, though, only dates back to the 70s with the Buckley versus Valeo decision, doesn't it, at least in terms of a legal doctrine?
This is true from a court perspective, but I think that court decision in Buckley v. Valeo and other ones have recognized a new environment in the United States in that, you know, there was a long time ago when you could go to your town corner and stand on your soapbox, and pretty much anyone who was involved in politics at the time would know what your position was and be able to go from there. These days, if you're running, for instance, in a presidential election or even a Senate election or a congressional election or in a state level, you can't get your message out unless you, for instance, have a website, unless you can go on TV or radio, unless you can travel. All of that takes money. And so the more you say you can't use that money, the less speech you have.
But, all right, but you don't need a lot of money for stuff like websites. I mean, you don't have to spend a whole lot more, certainly on a Facebook page, than you did just to set up a soapbox on a street corner, and you reach more people with the Facebook page, potentially.
Possibly, but again, and I'm not saying money is speech. I'm saying it's a proxy for, and there just simply is no way that you can say, look, if I told you tomorrow that you were going to go out and run a campaign and you couldn't spend more than $50, you'd have a harder time getting out a message, and that is simply the case that money does, in many ways, facilitate speech.
There are quite a few pages in The Intimidation Game on Karen Kenney. Why don't you tell us who she is?
Karen Kenney is this amazing woman. She is down in the San Fernando Valley. She started a Tea Party group, or she'd call it a group of constitutional conservatives, back in 2009. And they were among those that very interested in simply kind of civic work. They did a lot of parades around town for Memorial Day. They wanted to encourage people to get out to vote, not even in a partisan way, just put up signs saying go vote in elections. And to do all that, they applied to the IRS to get nonprofit status, and they were among the more than 300 groups that were targeted by the IRS because of their political views and their name. And ultimately, Karen gave up trying to get her application because the IRS had sent her so many abusive and intrusive questionnaires.
Well, she certainly got an education even before that on forming an official group. I mean, why have to file with the IRS in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. And I think one of the things that this book does, or at least I hope, it's kind of the beginning to the end story of what we know about the IRS so far. And if you know anything about the IRS and how it operates, its goal, its job, should never have been to be inquiring into these groups and sending them harassing things. You go, you apply, you say, this is what I am. They're supposed to give you your paper saying you're a nonprofit. And until and unless you somehow violate the law in the future or show that you somehow didn't follow the law, everything is good. So what the IRS did here was totally out of keeping with what the agency had ever done in the past.
The procedure had always been to go ahead and essentially rubber stamp things, and then if there was a complaint, to go back and investigate? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. When you then file, you go and you get your status, and then later you have to file your first sort of tax returns and documents with them. And if it looks as though any of your spending violated any of the IRS's rules about nonprofits, then they would come and give you a call. But prior to this, this was supposed to be about a 3-4, maybe at the most 6-week process to get your nonprofit papers.
All right, so the nonprofit papers, this is where things get really, really interesting. As you point out, everybody's familiar with 501c3s. The foundation that supports this radio operation is a 501c3. Now, this is a 501c4, and they get, what, the 501c16 or 501c30 or something?
They go all the way up. I think there's 20-some different designations, C, D, E, F, all of these different types. So 501c4 is a type of organization. It's called a social welfare organization. And, you know, by definition, the IRS was always very generous in that description and giving that status, because your definition of social welfare might be entirely different to someone else's definition of welfare. And it's kind of something where you get to decide yourself what would be good for the country. This is what I promote, and this is my organization that supports it.
All right, so the 501c4s are not supposed to be overtly political, but how clearly are the lines drawn?
So they can be political, but they have a test in the IRS that you can only up to about half of your spending kind of outright support political candidates. The rest of it, the majority of what you do has to be devoted to your social welfare purpose. Now, for instance, some of these groups, their social welfare purpose is to educate people about the Constitution and the First Amendment. Some of them had to do with other aspects of government or policy. Now, even if that, again, if that is your primary purpose, you can still nonetheless get involved in elections and give support to candidates and causes. It just can't be your main purpose.
Okay, so less than half of the time. Time by the clock. We talk about half your time, half your money, or I mean, is it all just
time by spending? I mean, it's counted by spending, so half of your spending.
Okay. So, but you usually, as you point out, the scrutiny when somebody starts an organization like a 501c4 is usually nothing?
It's really not much. I mean, unless you have just completely mistakenly filled out your papers. You know, like, for instance, I seem to remember one of those designations, there's a 50C something, a number, and those are for cemetery organizations. So,
right.
For instance, if you misfilled out your papers in some dramatic way and applied for a status that you just clearly are not, normally the IRS just looked and said, okay, you've got your articles of incorporation in order, you filled out all the stuff about your officers, this is what you are, and we'll wait and see until we get your first, you know, tax returns back to make sure you're doing what you're supposed to be doing.
Okay, so you're saying the IRS didn't do the kinds of things it did with Karen Kenny et al. In that period in history previously, but there is another section of the book where you take us a little further back in time to talk about the harassment of civil rights organizations, and this is, I think, the key that will help a lot of people understand the desire for anonymity. Can you go with us on the stuff that happened in Alabama back in the 50s and 60s?
Yeah, this is hugely important because, as you know, there's a big debate going on these days about disclosure. And you'll probably have read a lot, there's groups that are saying we need more disclosure in elections. What's interesting is this is a shift because you go back to the 50s and 60s, and it's the civil rights period. And we had a very famous Supreme Court case called the NAACP versus Alabama. And in that case, you had a senior state official in Alabama, the attorney general, who was very unhappy with the NAACP because it was in a state it had been integrally involved in the Montgomery bus boycott. And in general, if you were more on the keeping of Alabama's Jim Crow laws, you did not like the NAACP. And he did a very threatening thing. He sued the NAACP, claiming it had violated a state law. But in the process of that, he demanded that the NAACP turn over a list of all of its members. And, you know, this is a period of time in which blacks were still being lynched. There was firebombings. There were assassinations. The NAACP understood that if they turned over this list, it would be, you know, a hit list. And so it fought it all the way up to the Supreme Court. And in a very important decision, which was decided unanimously, the court said, look, you not only have a right to the First Amendment of free speech, you not only have a right to free assembly and for people to come together in groups like the NAACP, but in order for both of those to work, you also have to have a right to anonymity and be able to operate sometimes in politics without everybody knowing your name.
as a legal doctrine, has the idea of anonymity sort of ebbed and flowed through various court decisions and newly written laws?
Yes, and that's been the problem, is that this was the court's view, and it strongly defended it for another decade, even more than a decade. And then, as you mentioned, we had Watergate and all of the scandal involved in that, and then our first campaign finance laws. And, of course, campaign finance laws said the first big one, which is called FICA, said that there had to be disclosure in who you gave your campaign money to and how politicians spent it. And the court's way of doing this, they never overturned NAACP versus Alabama. But what they did is they kind of took a parallel track, and they said, yes, we know we have these decisions about anonymity, but sunshine is also good. So we're going to hold up these disclosure laws. And what we can do is, if anybody actually looks as though they're going to be threatened or intimidated, they can just come back to the court, and then in that case, we'll stop disclosure. And I think that worked for a while, but these days, in a day and age in which the minute you make a campaign donation, it goes up online, there is no time for people to go back and seek redress from the court. And so we have had, in the last 10 years, some truly appalling and worrisome examples of people's names getting taken off of disclosure lists and then for the express purpose so that they can be harassed.
Kimberly Strassel is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She works at the Wall Street Journal, member of the editorial board, and she's written a book called The Intimidation Game, How the Left is Silencing Free Speech, which deals largely with the IRS notoriety and attention to the Tea Party type groups beginning back in 2010. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. This sounds like a constant tug of war, though, the idea of anonymity, though, because you've got the desires of individuals to not get harassed for what they're doing, but you've also got the desire of the greater public to have some idea, in a system awash in money, where some of this flows from.
You do, and a big point of my book is trying to get people to rethink disclosure, because what's happened is it's been turned on its head, and we've gotten away from the point, because the point should be, as you said, to be able to keep track of what government is doing and making sure that no one's being corrupted, that no one's being bought off. But increasingly, disclosure became such a mania, it's been applied instead to citizens. And in situations where it's hard to argue why it should happen to them. The great story, in fact, in California, which you'll know because you probably covered it, but back during the Prop 8 campaign over gay marriage, there were a number of Californians who supported that ballot amendment to the Constitution in favor of traditional marriage. And they had their names taken off the disclosure list and put on searchable, walkable maps by activists, who then proceeded to go house to house in their neighborhoods. They had their cars keyed. They had their windows broken. There were threatening messages left on their voicemails. There was flash protests outside their small businesses. And some people lost their jobs, the most famous one being Brendan Eich, who worked at Mozilla. So that's when, and you have to ask the question, is there any reasonable reason why we should be keeping track of people's donations to ballot initiatives? These are people expressing their interest in a public policy change. There isn't anybody to be bought off or corrupted, and especially when that information is being used for unfortunate purposes.
There's an interesting, you go through a couple of different Supreme Court decisions here, including the McIntyre decision that had Scalia and Stevens on opposite sides. Nothing new there, but not the sides you'd expect.
Yeah, that's a really interesting court case. This is a woman who wanted to protest a bond measure at her school in Ohio. And she put out leaflets opposing it and signed it, a concerned citizen in one place. And interesting, one of the people who was on the other side started doing this. They knew who she was, but they nonetheless filed a complaint with the Ohio Elections Commission saying that she had broken the law by not identifying herself on that flyer, as was required under Ohio disclosure rules. And this went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And as you said, a majority of the court did uphold her right to remain anonymous under many of the prior holdings that we just talked about. Scalia, interestingly, was in dissent, and he was always a strange character on free speech. His argument was that Americans have a patriotic duty to stand up and that if bad things happen to you, that was just part of your duty. It's never been a position that I entirely agree with. There are some people who are brave enough to go out there. I'm not quite sure you should have to be brave just to take part in democracy. But it was interesting. He was always on the opposite side, or often on the opposite side, for instance, of Justice Clarence Thomas, who usually in many of these decisions not only agreed with the majority about anonymity, but went much farther in arguing that we should severely cut back on disclosure laws.
So when it comes to things like dark money, you say that the left exaggerates the amount of money out there. What kind of figures do you have to compare with the ones they throw around?
So, you know, if you take a look, and this is in the book, in the 2012 election period, the country spent about $7 billion on elections. And, you know, that may sound
at
like
all levels, including money, presidential?
I believe it's including presidential. The question is, I'm not quite sure how far down it goes at the state level, but this is certainly the presidential level and federal elections. And I know that, as I said, sounds like a lot of money, but I also think it's worthwhile being put into context. You know, Americans spend $7 billion every year on Halloween. So in my mind, the process of electing our government, it's the most basic and sort of sacred job we have in a democracy. Is it worth as much money as we spend every year on Halloween? I think it probably is. Then if you look at the $7 billion that we do spend out there, about 3% of that is what the left likes to call dark money. And the other way of looking at that, again, I think it's context, is it really dark money? What it is it's that money we were just talking about. People, for instance, who made donations to nonprofit groups and things, who are allowed to retain some anonymity over their donors because of sort of prior rulings and federal law because of anonymity questions.
Well, all right. So we've already talked about the 501c4s. You also bring up the 527s in here, and I know we've heard about both groups, and there are some limits on what they can do. How do those compare side by side, the 501c4s and the 527s?
Well, look, I think that's the point about these numbers is, you know, only about 3% of money is anonymous out there in politics. That means 97% of it is disclosed. And that includes all the major super PACs that people talk about, for instance, 527s and things like this. It's mostly smaller groups that still have some measure of anonymity in their donations and their spending.
All right, we have a call here from George in Wairika. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Kimberly Strassel. Her book is The Intimidation Game.
Wow, well, that's certainly interesting, and it does certainly portend the ability of power to go in the direction of money. The IRS equally targeted the left wing. What they found out that the right wing Tea Partiers, 90% of their money went to the fomenting of political situations. Now, you're making things safe for the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson and the left-wing person. I find that their money is intolerable in a democracy.
All right. Thanks for the thoughts, George. Appreciate that. Kimberly, response?
Well, I think democracy wants to be able to hear from all sides, and we would hope so. And this is my beef, by the way, with a lot of campaign finance laws and speech laws, is that if you look over the history of the country, and this is documented in the book, almost all of those have come about in response to some sort of crisis or scandal in Washington, and then they were abused by one side or another to put restrictions on their political opponents. And, you know, by the way, both sides of the aisle have been equally bad about this. You go back and, Teddy Roosevelt, he'd gotten trouble for some of his spending that corporations had given him when he was reelected, and he decided that he was going to turn around and helped pass a campaign finance law against corporations. The right used World War II and some strikes as an excuse to put restrictions on campaign finance and spending on unions, because unions were one of the biggest thorns in their side. And you can go forward and go back and forth on both sides, and they've done this. And that was why we ended up with Citizens United, by the way, because the restrictions kept piling up and piling up until the court said, we can no longer sign off on this because too many people in too many categories have lost their free speech rights. So, I mean, I'm not quite sure where the caller came up with the idea that this was the IRS's abuse was equally done on the right and the left. You know, even the Treasury Department Inspector General noted that the vast, vast majority, more than 90% of those were targeted, were all from one political perspective, from the right. And, you know, I have never seen anything. Most of these people have never actually, a lot of them didn't get their not-for-profit status until relatively recently after the scandal was broken. So to know what they were spending their money on is still something that is not clear, because a lot of them have waited so long to get their papers that they haven't even been through any sort of election cycle yet.
Do you see ways, Kimberly, to change the system? Because, I mean, a lot of people are dissatisfied with the amount of money in politics and whether it is legal or not, the perception that the voices that get heard the most by members of Congress are the voices that are also busy writing checks to the campaigns of the members of Congress. I mean, is there some way, and it sounds like there have been lots of efforts through history, left and right, to regulate spending, but it always ends up getting used against somebody else from the way you paint the picture.
Well, and I think that that's actually true. And I guess, again, I have a slightly different view of spending. You know, I look, for instance, out there at union groups, okay? One union member on their own is not a very strong voice. But everyone comes together and they pool their money and suddenly their voice is heard. You know, interesting, even Hillary Clinton, at least the last election cycle, made this point. That spending by groups, we call them special interests, but often they are assemblies of ordinary Americans who are trying to be heard. So it looks like big spending, but it isn't. It's often representative of smaller Americans.
All right, so you don't see any particular restrictions that you would favor coming up?
No, I don't. Just because, I think more speech is better, and we as a society, what we should care more about is having a civil debate and more speech in a civil fashion.
All right. That might be the key right there, is having it be civil again. The Intimidation Game, How the Left is Silencing Free Speech, is the book by Kimberly Strassel of The Wall Street Journal. Thank you for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Take care.